Produced at CFIS-FM in Prince George, Health First is available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We've been talking to Michael Newton Keys. He's the author of the new book, Unbelievable, and he is a historian and a scientist. So fascinating. We're just talking about how science and religion are not really as far apart as we thought. And in the first bit, we were talking about how the thought that the Earth is round, how did they challenge that and get those concepts across in medieval times?
Sure. Well, imagine you're a university student in the year 1200. When you come to the topic of Earth and its shape, you would have learned things like this to support a round Earth based on observation. During a lunar eclipse, that's when the Earth's shadow covers up the moon, as the Earth's shadow creeps across the face of the moon, the edge of that shadow is distinctly curved, indicating that the thing casting the shadow, Earth, is also round. And there were, like I said, about a half dozen arguments like that that pointed to a round Earth. One more would be, as you travel further north on our planet, the North Star appears higher and higher above your horizon until finally, if you get to the North Pole, the North Star is directly over your head. And so that gives you an idea of how far north and south you are on a curved planet. That wouldn't happen if the planet was flat. And it's so university students in the Middle Ages, during the Christian Middle Ages, understood this and were able to argue for this effectively. So it's only later that people invented this idea that people in the Middle Ages thought the Earth was flat, and it was invented by those who wanted to paint Darwin doubters as anti-science. You're like those medieval Christians who thought the Earth was flat and are anti-rational and anti-science. It turns out this myth is a modern myth. It's a 19th century myth that was used against Darwin doubters who had scientific reasons to doubt Darwin's theory to paint them like they were anti-intellectual just because they were Christian. Well, in this case, the atheists just got their history wrong. I mean, it's fine to be an atheist, but at least get your history right, right? Don't falsify history to support your atheism.
Right. Okay, let's go back to that philosopher, Giordano Bruno. He was burned alive in 1600, and he was a martyr, right?
Yeah, he was burned at the stake by the Catholic Church in the year 1600, and that's not a myth, that's true, but the myth is that he was martyred for science, for the cause of science, and it turns out that although he did support the Copernican view, that is, that the idea the Earth moves, that was the view that Galileo was defending, which we discussed earlier. He did defend the Copernican view, but he misunderstood a lot of Copernicus science, and he was coming at it more as a philosopher and as a theologian. And he, in fact, contemporary scientists like Johannes Kepler, who I cited earlier, he referred to Kepler's philosophy as a dreadful philosophy because he was so messed up in his mind about what Copernicus actually wrote. So, yeah, he was burnt at the stake because he didn't believe in the deity of Jesus Christ and a few other doctrines. One of his doctrines was Jesus was just one more traveling soul that was in a body for some time on this planet and then moved from planet to planet, and there was life all over the universe, and Jesus would appear on many different planets, just like you and I would appear on different planets in different lifetimes. Now, that's an ancient pagan view, actually, that he imported into Christianity, and he got in trouble for it. Now, most Christians throughout all of history have been against burning heretics. The whole idea is bad. You know, you shouldn't burn people for their ideas, regardless
right.
of what they are. But there, unfortunately, the Catholic Church got a little heavy-handed during this time period, and they did some things that they later are embarrassed about. So I get the history right, but I show that, yeah, he was a martyr, but he was a martyr for free speech, not a martyr for science, because he really didn't understand the science very well.
And how do you, as a historian, how do you get back that far and know what was the truth of what was going on in that day and age?
Well, you know, you have to either know the primary languages and the primary sources yourself, or know who are the best historians who have that primary language, you know, the Latin, and in this case, it's primarily Latin, was the intellectual language of Europe. So reputable scholars, and I have friends, many friends, I'm, you know, my PhD is in history of science, I know the field, So I don't just go on the internet and right. try to find answers, because you find all kinds of false information that just gets repeated over and over and over. So I go to the sources that I know are reliable and often primary sources, and especially when they're English translation. And I cite, I've got 500 footnotes in my book. So anyone who picks up my book can see that I go to reputable sources and I'm not just making this stuff up.
Mm-hmm. Michael, how long did it take you to do all this research and write this book?
Well, you know, I mentioned I've taught astronomy for 25 years, and I've been a historian of science during that same 25 years of teaching, and there's so many of these myths that my students, before they took my courses, believed, and I kept running into them. So I thought, you know, it's time to go public with this. So it's really been over the last 25 years that I've worked on the book, but it's only in the last couple of years I finally finished it up, and I've had so much fun with this, done a lot of speaking, and it's fun to enlighten people. Whether they're atheist or Christian or otherwise, to, you know, at least get the history right.
Mm-hmm. With such an expansive amount of information here, like there, you've gone through so much. What is the takeaway? What do you really want people to take away from this book?
Well, you know, I've got a lot of free YouTubes that will tell you some of that. I'll give you a description of that. But just before I forget, if you just Google my last name, K-E-A-S, and unbelievable, then you'll find lots of little short YouTubes about it, as well as how to buy my book. But, so the easy way to remember that is unbelievable chaos, because Keys, K-E-A-S, K-E-A-S, almost looks like chaos. So if you Google unbelievable chaos, you'll find my stuff. But the take-home lessons include, look, science and Christianity have had a long history of playing well together, of actually being mutually reinforcing. But when people misinterpret history, they'll get the wrong idea that being religious, particularly being Christian, is necessarily anti-science. Well, history doesn't show that. So you can, you know, you still have to make up on your mind what you're going to believe about whether God exists, but at least this takes away the objection that being religious or specifically Christian is not anti-science. In fact, it's had a long history of being pro-science, very productive, very good for cultural and intellectual development.
Okay, let's take you way back to Copernicus. He made that revolutionary argument that the Earth revolved around the sun. Did he demote Earth and thus discredit religion? And was that his idea?
Yeah, again, it has kind of that superficial appearance, because we normally think today of, you know, if you're in the center of something, that's the place of importance. And to be removed from the center would be removed from a place of importance. But in the ancient way of looking at the cosmos, which Copernicus inherited and then, of course, transformed, looking at the center of the universe, according to Aristotle, he's an ancient pagan Greek author, the center of the universe was the bottom of the universe, the place where things can fall apart and corrupt, whereas up in the sky, above the Earth, is the heavenly realm, which he thought was totally incorruptible, not subject to, changes other than just circular motion. And so when Copernicus made a good argument that Earth moves, of course it wasn't conclusive, not even Galileo could prove it, but it was a pretty good argument. He actually thought of it, and Galileo also thought of it, and Kepler as well, as a kind of a promotion, because now Earth was one of the planets. We're up, we join the dance of the stars. We're not at the bottom of the universe after all. So I think that what people do is they read the modern understanding of center as the place of importance. They read it back into the past and misinterpret the history. And my book explains how that gets all mixed up and what the correct view is. That Copernicus himself was he wrote that the universe was created for our sake. That doesn't sound like a devotion for humanity, does it, Kathy?
Not really. No. Do you believe that the futuristic myth that science is really going to replace religion? Is that one thing that you bring out in your book?
Yeah, that's the seventh and final myth out of my seven myths that I debunk in my book. And I call this the extraterrestrial enlightenment myth. And it's the idea that is increasingly popular among scientists and philosophers today who don't believe in God, who say that if aliens are to arrive on this planet, because of the vast distances that they would need to travel to even possibly habitable planets, and we still haven't found a truly Earth-like planet out there yet. We've found about 4,000 planets outside of our solar system, but none of them really meet up all the conditions that needed for really complex and intelligent life. But let's just suppose there are some out there. The distances are so vast that the technology to get to Earth would have to be so great, that so more advanced than what we know, that many scientists and philosophers are saying, hey, if they arrive, their technology would be indistinguishable from magic. It would look supernatural to us, and their morality would be highly evolved, because they would have had billions of years probably to have evolved past us. So they would be morally and spiritually superior to us. But I show that although this kind of sounds scientific, it really isn't, for a number of reasons. I'll give you just a couple.
Okay.
One thing you must not forget: technology can never overcome natural laws. Natural laws you can't make a perpetual motion machine, for example, a machine that will power a machine that will power the original machine such that you never have to add fuel. That's impossible. There are certain universal negatives we know about nature. And the same thing with the speed of light. That's the maximum speed limit for ordinary objects and for communication. And so there's only a small portion of the universe that could potentially even communicate with us if there are aliens out there, or travel to us if they exist. So the likelihood of actual contact of aliens on Earth is very, very small based on natural science. So let's just suppose, Kathy, there is some creature that appears on Earth that is doing things that look like miracles. Well, there's going to be a debate between those who say they're aliens and it's all natural, and those who would say it actually is supernatural. These are supernatural beings who may not have good intentions, you know. And so that debate is not going to be solved, but this myth, this extraterrestrial enlightenment myth, actually sets us up to a potential massive misunderstanding, even deception, because it gives a naturalistic story that expects what will look like the supernatural, but they'll say, oh, it's just natural after all.
Okay, so as a scientist and historian, and you've done your homework, you don't think there are extraterrestrials?
I'm undecided about whether ET exists or not. What my book hones in on is the likelihood of contact, not the likelihood of whether they exist. The universe is really big. They might exist out there. But the likelihood of contact, and I crunched the numbers following a Harvard astrophysicist who's done a lot of this, the likelihood of actual contact with aliens is extremely small. And so if the appearance of vastly superior creatures on the planet, there's going to be a real debate over whether they're natural or supernatural. And I think that debate ought to take place. And it's not a foregone conclusion, oh, of course, they're aliens.
Right. Michael, tell us just where can we find your new book, Unbelievable?
If you go to unbelievablemyths.com, that's unbelievablemyths, plural.com, it takes you right to the Amazon page for it.
Okay. And where do you see your work going now after this book? Can you see another book on the horizon?
Oh, I've got numerous book ideas in my head. In fact, I retired from teaching in order to become a full-time author. So, and my middle name happens to be Newton, which is really fun. My parents had no idea I was going to become a historian of science. So if you just Google Michael Newton Keys, eventually you'll find lots of books out there. It'll take me a couple years to get my next one out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the conversation today.
Thanks, Kathy. It's been fun.
Okay. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have our second guest.